It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Kate Archer Kent. Mildred Fish Harnack was many things. An American woman at the heart of the German resistance to Hitler. A spy, a war hero, an English teacher, a University of Wisconsin graduate student, a Milwaukee native, a casualty. She was just 26 years old when she left behind her family in Wisconsin and moved to Germany with her German husband, whom she met at UW. She grew increasingly concerned about the rise of Nazism. She began publishing underground newsletters, organizing resistance, and feeding information to the United States and Russian governments about Nazi activity. Her life could have been a footnote lost to history, but recently her story has been re-examined and chronicled in a new book. It's called All the Frequent Troubles of Our Days, and it was written by our guest this morning, Rebecca Donner. Mildred Fish Harnack was her great aunt. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me today as your guest.
So glad you could join us today. We here in Wisconsin, we celebrate Mildred Fish Harnack Day each year on September 16th, which was her birthday. And I wonder,
yes.
Who was she to you in your life?
Well, it's interesting. I first encountered her name actually when I was 9, and I was at my great-grandmother's house in Chevy Chase, Maryland, and she was measuring my height against the kitchen wall. And I stepped back and looked at the marks along the wall and the others who had stood there and had their height measured. And I saw one very faint mark, and there was an M next to it. And I asked her, "Who's that?" And she said, "Well, that's your great-great-aunt, Mildred." But she said nothing more. And I sensed a kind of tension in her voice. And I think for me, that's when the mystery of Mildred began, when I was 9. But I didn't find out the larger story until I was a teenager, about 16. And then my grandmother, Jane, told me much more about her, her work in the resistance, and how she was executed by guillotine, which was just a horrific revelation. And she gave me Mildred's letters, and she said she knew that I wanted to be a writer and that I wanted to write great books one day. And she said, "You know, Rebecca, you must write this story." So for me, then at 16, she became a promise that I would keep to my grandmother. She was a mystery to me, and she was grew to be a source of inspiration the more that I learned about her story.
And what a moment that must have been for you as a writer to discover this family history and this rich story to be told.
Yes, indeed.
How were you able to finally bring this story to light? I imagine it must have been so hard to access some of the documents and some of the people that you would need to talk to in order to bring this story to light.
Yes, most definitely. There are holes in the story that still exist. I was determined to look under every stone and research every archive, and I did extensive research, not only across the United States, and I went to Wisconsin too, but also in England. I went to London, the National Archives there. There are espionage files that I accessed. I went to the National Archives and the Library of Congress in the U.S. I also went to Berlin, and there is an archive called the Gedenkstätte Deutsche Widerstand, which is the German Resistance Memorial Center. And I found a treasure trove of documents and primary source documents there, including notes that were passed in prison among Mildred's co-conspirators, women, who this was how they communicated with one another this was after they were all arrested and they were prohibited to talk with one another. They were awaiting a mass treason trial. And one of these notes that I found, basically the woman who was writing the note, wrote about Mildred and wrote about the woman in their group who betrayed her to a Gestapo interrogator. So this note is a photograph of this note is featured in my book. I also, and many other documents too, I should say, my book is peppered throughout with intelligence documents, declassified intelligence documents, and notes and scraps of journal entries. And so I all of these different sources that I use to tell this story. And another primary source was Don Heath, who was Mildred's 11-year-old courier in 1939. He was the son of an American diplomat at the U.S. Embassy in Berlin. And my grandmother actually told me about him when I was 16. Twice a week between 1939 and 1941, Don visited Mildred's apartment ostensibly for tutoring sessions. And at the end of a session, Mildred would slip a note into his knapsack, which he would then pass on to his father, a diplomat at the U.S. Embassy in Berlin, who had a confidential arrangement with Secretary of Treasury Henry Morgenthau Jr., Assistant Secretary of State George Messersmith, and Under Secretary of State Sumner Wells to obtain intelligence from key sources in Berlin. So I interviewed Don Heath when he was 89 years old, and the Heath family also gave me exclusive access to 12 steamer trunks filled with letters and date books and diaries. And so these became more sources that I drew on to tell this story.
Wow. As you're describing that, I feel like I can almost smell the parchment paper.
Yes. So it was really startling. Don Heath's mother, Louise Heath, kept a diary. And when I was interviewing him, he mentioned the diary a few times. And I kept saying, "Oh, Don, where is that diary? I'd love to look at it." And he said, "Oh, it's gone. It's gone in Berlin after, was destroyed during the war." And so it was a big surprise to reach into one of these steamer trunks and to withdraw really just an ordinary looking manila envelope that was, that had a smell, old paper, mm-hmm. as you say. And then in it, I withdrew her diaries, and it was an absolute treasure.
Well, I want to hear more about that. And I want to make sure that we understand the origin story of where she came from and how she got to be in this position of international espionage in Germany. So can you start us off? She was born in Milwaukee. She went to college, UW-Madison, and that's where she met her husband.
Yes.
Who became...
Indeed, yes, those are the key biographical points that are important to understand Mildred, who she was and how she came to be a leader in the underground resistance in Germany. And it's interesting to me, she grew up in a rather impoverished household. She lived in a shuffle of boarding houses. She was the fourth and youngest child of Georgina Fish, who was a self-taught typist, and William Cook Fish, who was a frequently unemployed insurance salesman / butcher. At one point, he sold salted meats, and he also was a horse trader, and he was frequently unemployed. And this was why they moved frequently, whenever they couldn't pay the rent. And neither William nor Georgina had gone to college. But in 1921, Mildred declared her desire to enroll at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, which accepted both men and women, and where tuition was free to state residents. Mildred, I should mention, was Georgina Fish. Her mother was a suffragette, and Mildred was deeply inspired by the progressive movement in Wisconsin, which was the first state to ratify the 19th Amendment in 1919 and grant women the right to vote. So here she was at the University of Wisconsin. She received her bachelor's degree in humanities, and then she went on to receive her master's degree in 1926. And this was when she met Arvid Harnack, who was a German, working on his PhD, and he was a German student on a Rockefeller scholarship. And they fell in love. And there's a story that I can tell that's quite lovely about how they met, but I'm just sort of hitting the broad strokes of it. We can get to that if you like.
I do want to. We're speaking with Rebecca Donner, the author of All the Frequent Troubles of Our Days, a biography of Mildred Fish Harnack, who was executed for her resistance to the Nazis in Germany. I'm Molly Stentz, and this is The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're speaking with Rebecca Donner, author of the new book, All the Frequent Troubles of Our Days. It chronicles the life of Milwaukee native Mildred Fish Harnack. Do you think people have a duty to resist wrongdoing by their government? What's the most effective way to resist laws that you find to be immoral? We're at 1-800-642-1234, ideas@wpr.org. What do you want to know about the life of Mildred Fish Harnack? Well, we have a call for you, Rebecca, coming in from Glendale. We have Gary on the line this morning that has a question for you. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning, and thank you for having Rebecca on live. Her scheduled presentation in Milwaukee was sold out 2 weeks or 2 days after the her article appeared from Jim Higgins in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. So it's good to have a question online. At least I don't think I wasn't able to get a seat.
Sure.
In my experience doing research on the Milwaukee socialists, I became very familiar with Richard Arvid's major professor, Richard R. Commons.
John not, Commons,
not,
yes.
Not Richard, John R. Commons, excuse me. And I had an advanced look at your book, and his name was not in the index, so when my wife gave me a copy of it for my birthday last week, I did some targeting searching through your book, and I have to compliment you on the terrific research you did. And having worked at some of the articles both here and in Germany, in my work on the Milwaukee Socialists and my doctoral dissertation on the agrarian history of the Weimar Republic, you do a terrific job.
What was on your mind, Gary?
I'm getting to the question right now. Which is when I did my targeted search since getting the book, you do not mention William Ellery Leonard, it seems, and you don't give a lot of attention to the Friday group on in Madison, which Professor Commons, I believe, organized, and which socialism was a big part of that discussion, since Commons had provided the Milwaukee Socialists with some of the reform ideas based on the SPD program, the revisionist SPD program. Now,
I should just jump in here, Gary.
Please,
if you don't
Rebecca.
Mind. I actually I do talk about the Friday Nighters in a chapter having to do with one of Mildred's friends at the University of Wisconsin, Greta Lorca, who went on to become Greta Kukoff and was one of the key members of their group. And really, the Friday Nighters, there's a chapter in which I describe Mildred, and this is actually from Greta Lorca's memoir. She describes seeing Mildred skating with Arvid, and this is an evening party, and there's a big fire, and everybody's roasting meat on sticks, and so I don't know if you saw that that part of the book when you were going through. But in any case, I do describe a bit about the group and what they discussed. John Commons was, of course, a very interesting figure too, and I speak about him. I'm sorry, whoever did the index didn't add Commons to it, but yes, he was an important figure as well, And I do describe how Arvid was basically intending to visit John Commons's lecture on labor unions and wandered into the wrong lecture hall. And there, instead of John Commons, was Mildred Harnock, who was then a 25-year-old graduate student. And the topic of her lecture was American literature, not labor unions. And he thought, well, I'm going to stay and watch. And this was their first meeting. So Molly, I had alluded to earlier that there was this meeting that yes. we know about the first time. And that was indeed, John Commons was sort of peripherally involved with that because Arvid made that crucial mistake going to the wrong lecture hall. In any case, Gary, if you had a question, I'm happy to answer it.
Well, and to Gary's point, I think the thing that he brings up that's been on my mind is the, where did the radicalization come from, or how did she come to be a 20-year-old graduate student who then moves to Germany and leads this resistance group and stands up against an entire government and a regime and has this momentous life? How did that come to be?
Well, yes, that is the salient question. And I do, again, think that her Wisconsin roots very much played a role in that. I think she was radicalized at the University of Wisconsin. She was involved with the Friday Nighters and they would get together, and it was a sort of a feisty group of students and led by John Commons. And she got the idea too, that it was important to stand up for what you believed in. And so when she met Arvid, who also shared her passion for women's rights, you know, after they got married, they hitchhiked to Colorado and participated in a strike and joined the picket lines with the coal miners, protesting poor pay and working conditions. And this is just one example of several that I give in the book of how she and teamed up with Arvid and became socially active, politically active. And then in 1929, she decided to move to Germany and to join Arvid there and to pursue her PhD. And it must be remembered that in 1928, just a year before she arrived in Germany, less than 3%, the Nazi Party received less than 3% of the vote in the Reichstag election. And the Reichstag is the German parliament. And then just 2 years later, 18%. Of the vote. And then 2 years later, in 1932, the Nazi Party received 37% of the vote. And for the first time, it was the largest political party in the Reichstag. And during this time, Mildred was there as an American from Wisconsin, bearing witness to the rapid rise of fascism in Berlin. And that is when she decided to do something about it.
And what was their first step? What was their first step in resisting?
Well, Mildred at that time was working on her dissertation for her PhD, and she was taking classes at the University of Gießen, and also she was lecturing about American literature at the University of Berlin. And it was there where she found a pool of recruits, potential recruits, people, students there were some of her students who were indeed sympathetic to the Nazi Party and were members of the Nazi fraternity. She also had students in her class who were incredibly opposed to the Nazi Party. And so she began holding meetings in their Berlin apartment, and she invited students, like-minded students, friends of friends. It was a diverse group. Arvid also invited friends and friends of friends. It started as a very small, scrappy group of political activists, and it was really just a discussion group at first. This is a year before Hitler was chancellor. The group would grow over the course of 8 years and intersect with at least three other underground resistance groups, Tatkreis, Rittmeisterkreis, and Gegnerkreis, and it formed an interlocking chain. And by 1940, there were approximately 60 Germans in this group, which continued to recruit new members as the Second World War progressed. So you might think, well, 60 isn't very many, but it must be remembered, and it wasn't. And this group never posed a serious threat to the Nazi regime. But nevertheless, they continued to oppose the Nazi dictatorship and do whatever they could to resist. In 1933, when Hitler became chancellor, Germany very swiftly progressed from a parliamentary democracy to a totalitarian dictatorship. And so it became increasingly difficult for Mildred to recruit Germans into the resistance because she was risking her life in doing so. She could have been arrested if she tried to recruit the wrong person and she was turned over to the Gestapo. She knew that she faced a risk.
Such a huge risk. And I want to hear more about that after we take this news break. We'll continue our conversation with Rebecca Donner. Her book is called All the Frequent Trouble of Our Days. I'm Molly Stentz. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're speaking with Rebecca Donner, author of the new book, All the Frequent Troubles of Our Days. It chronicles the life of Milwaukee native and Nazi resistor Mildred Fish Harnack. If your country were overrun with Nazis, do you think you would flee or would you fight back? What do you want to know about the remarkable life of Mildred Fish Harnack? We're at 1-800-642-1234. ideas@wpr.org. Rebecca, so you were describing Mildred's life in Germany and how she was organizing her friends, reaching out, the risk that she was under in trying to establish who else might feel and think the way she did. I understand she was fired from her job at one point.
From the University of Berlin. Yes, for her political views.
And then she went on to organize this resistance group. She published newsletters. What were some of the other ways in which she organized resistance?
She also, in addition to these leaflets, which were basically denounced the Nazi regime and called for revolution, she translated speeches by other leaders in other countries, including FDR, and translated them for Germans at a time when there was all the news was censored, and Germans had no access to news outside of Germany. She also helped Jews escape. She plotted acts of sabotage. And during the Second World War, she did become involved in espionage, at first passing documents about Hitler's operational strategies and military strategies to the United States using the 11-year-old boy, Don Heath, who I mentioned earlier. And then she also did the same for the Soviet Union. Basically, their strategy was to deliver documents that would be helpful to Hitler's enemies.
Yes. How did she come to know Don Heath?
Oh, well, through my grandmother, actually, which is through the American School in Berlin. My grandmother followed in Mildred's footsteps. And at the age of 21, she moved to Berlin just to stay with Mildred and Arvid for about 9 months. And she started teaching at the American School of Berlin. And she met Don Heath there. So that's sort of one point of contact. But the primary point of contact was through Don Heath's mother, Louise Heath, who would go to the American Women's Club in Berlin to see Mildred give lectures, lunchtime and tea time lectures on American literature. And it was there that Louise Heath introduced herself to Mildred and invited her to a lunch and invited Arvid as well. And this was the first point of contact between the Heaths and the Harnocks. And Louise writes about this in her diary. So this was one example of how that diary was very helpful to me in understanding the progression of basically how they emerged or progressed from being friends to collaborators in the resistance.
And I understand you got to interview Don Heath.
Yes, I did. I was at an artist residency in New York. And when I discovered that he was still alive, I wasn't certain he was. He was just just shy of his 90th birthday. And I jumped onto an airplane and flew out to Northern California and sat down with him and interviewed him for days.
What did he recall at that point in his life? What stood out to him?
He had a very vivid memory of his boyhood. He recalled showing up at Mildred's apartment. He told me about the pastries that the cook, who turned out to be a Gestapo spy, actually. In their household, there was a cook. He called her a mamselle because he couldn't pronounce mademoiselle. She was the name. And so he described them as shaped like stars and crescent moons. And this is an example of the kind of detail he gave me. He described the routes that he would take and on the U-Bahn and which stops he would get off at. He described how he was instructed by his father to take a different route every time to Mildred's apartment in case he was followed, and how to look into the windows of stores to see if he was being followed. And he would go up to the top at the American Church in Berlin and looked down to see if anyone was following him. And so he really was, in a John le Carré novel.
Yeah. such a young age.
At such a young age. And I did go to Berlin and retrace his steps to make sure, that he remembered them accurately and the various routes he took. And he did.
Wow. Wow. So at what point do they realize that their lives are increasingly at risk? Obviously, there's a growing level of risk living in the country at that time. But yes. how is it that they realize that they're really under surveillance, under suspicion by the Gestapo?
Well, I think the first moment was in 1940 when the Gestapo raided their apartment. Arvid was working at that time and had been working for 5 years at the Ministry of Economics. He and Mildred were both leading a double life, pretending to be loyal Nazis and stealing top secret documents about Hitler's operational and military strategies. That's what Arvid was doing at his place of employment. And other members were doing this as well, those who basically insinuated themselves into the ministries. Haro Schulze-Boysen was another, and he was a senior lieutenant at the Luftwaffe. And so he had access to all of the military missions. He was the one who was initially arrested. I'm skipping ahead a bit, but in 1940, that was the Gestapo raided Mildred and Arvid's apartment and found nothing. But this was when they realized that they really had to be more cautious. In 1942, in the fall of 1942, or the late summer, Haro Schulze-Boysen was arrested, and his wife, Libertas, spread the word as quickly as she could to other members of the group basically the Gestapo was onto them. Mildred and Arvid fled to Nazi-occupied Lithuania, and they intended to escape to Sweden, and an SS officer named Horst Kopko traveled 500 miles to track them down and personally arrest them with a group of Gestapo officers. And so, and this was in September of 1942, he hauled them back to Gestapo headquarters in Berlin and threw them into the basement prison that would soon fill with all of their friends in the resistance.
And they're put on trial. And
yes,
at one point it appears as though perhaps she would be sentenced to work camp and maybe escape with her life, but that was not to be, because Hitler directly intervened. Why
That's
did she,
right.
Why did she attract such attention?
Well, and this is a question that we can't really answer with any certitude. We can only conjecture. She was the only American in the group, and she was put in solitary confinement, and she was prohibited from writing letters and reading books and communicating with anyone. And this was, she was treated differently than other members, including Arvid, who was allowed to write. He actually started writing another book while he was in prison. He also received visits from family members, including his brother, Falkarnak, who was a member of the White Rose, the Weiße Rose, who some people may be familiar with that resistance group.
Yes.
But Mildred, for 3.5 months, was kept in solitary confinement. She was interrogated and tortured by Walter Habecker, who was a sadistic Nazi known for his brutal torture techniques. In fact, several members of the group committed suicide when they learned that they would be interrogated by Habecker. Mm-hmm. And so Mildred, she got tuberculosis when she was in prison, but she demonstrated tremendous resilience, and she showed up to her day in court with others, including Arvid Harnack, for this treason trial in the German court, the Reich court martial, the Reichskriegsgericht, and she did receive a sentence of 6 years in prison at a work camp, and then 2 days later Hitler found out about this and reversed the sentence and ordered her execution. Why did he do this? Again, we must speculate. Falkarnak, Arvid's brother, after the war speculated that it was because she was an American and that he was angry that an American had infiltrated this group. But we don't know for sure. In any case, she was led to a guillotine, and on February 16th, 1943, she was strapped down and beheaded.
Mm. And her husband was executed as well.
Arvid Harnack was hanged, and yes, and when shortly before he was executed, he wrote a long letter to Mildred, and it's in my book. We have the letter. It's extraordinary that this letter survived, and it's just a gorgeous testament of love and of courage and personal sacrifice. And this letter basically was smuggled into her in her prison cell. And she read it many times. There was one woman who was, who shared her cell. They basically, the Nazi officials were concerned that she would commit suicide when she learned that she would face another trial. And Gertrude Klapeth was her name. And Mildred gave this letter to Gertrude and said, can you please keep this letter safe and give it back to the family? She treasured this letter. And Gertrude was transferred to the Ravensbrück concentration camp for women. And she kept her promise to Mildred. She survived. And after the war in 1952, she got in touch with Clara Harnack, Arvid Harnack's mother, and said, I have a letter for you.
Rebecca Donner, she is the author of the new book, All the Frequent Troubles of Our Days, a biography of Mildred Fish Harnack, who was executed for her resistance to the Nazis in Germany. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Molly Stentz. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're learning about the remarkable life of Milwaukee native Mildred Fish Harnack, who went on to lead an underground resistance movement to the Nazis in Germany. We're speaking with author Rebecca Donner. You can join us 1-800-642-1234 or ideas@wpr.org. Why do you think Mildred Fish Harnack's story isn't more well known? Oh, Rebecca, I want to ask you about the intelligence that Mildred provided to the U.S. and to the Russians. What ultimately became of it?
Well, some of the intelligence ended up in an archive in Moscow, and I was able to access even the report that assimilated a lot of intelligence that Arvid Harnack provided and Harlow Schulze-Boysen and other sources in the group. And this was a document that basically warned Stalin that Hitler was about to invade the Soviet Union. And Hitler refused, Stalin refused to believe this. In my book, I feature a photograph of this report. And you can see Stalin's handwriting across it. And he wrote an obscenity across the top of this report, demonstrating that he really didn't believe it. And he thought that the people who had provided this intelligence were lying to him. And of course, he was sorely wrong. Several days later, Hitler did indeed invade the Soviet Union. In terms of the intelligence that reached the United States between 1939 and 1941, I researched the archives in the United States, and I was able to, I'm trying to connect the dots, of course, and so much has been destroyed in the war, but there are these cables that Donald Heath Sr., who was at the U.S. Embassy in Berlin and placed there by Morgenthau, his nickname among his colleagues at the embassy was Morgenthau's man, and so he would send these by cable, these reports that contained information from sources, including Arvid. So I was able to read some of those documents. And it must be remembered, too, that even being caught with a document like this, put whoever was in its possession, would put them in profound danger. And so a lot of times, the notes that Mildred would slip into Don Heath Jr.'s knapsack would be basically a date and a time where they would meet outside of Berlin, away from Gestapo surveillance, and where they would deliver the information orally. And they would sort of give the impression of having a picnic, and the Heaths and the Harnacks would eat sandwiches, and then this is where the most sort of top secret information was exchanged. And Don Heath Jr. talked about how he would run around the paths and keep an eye out for anybody who might be watching. And this is again back when he was a lead character in his own John le Carré novel. And he dressed in a Hitler Youth uniform that his friend Mole stole for him. And so he played the part of this little Nazi little boy who was on the lookout, and he would whistle a certain tune if he saw somebody approach.
It's an incredible story. I mean, to hear you describe the scenes and to read them in the book, it really took me there. I'm seeing the images in my mind right now as you're describing this intense personal risk. And I know that it had an impact on their family life as well, when they lived in Germany. And I wonder what you can share about what else they put on the line to do this, to try to raise this issue, to try to alert the Americans and the Russians, as you mentioned, tragically, ultimately, to no effect. What other personal tolls did this take on them?
Well, I can speak about Mildred most specifically. I think that she visited. I have a lot of documents that describe what she was like in 1937. So this is before the war, but already there an emotional toll. She suffered greatly just by leading this double life and pretending to be the loyal American wife of a Nazi official at the Ministry of Economics. She went back to the United States. Her mother was dying in 1937. She also saw other members of her family. She went to Wisconsin. She visited her brother, who was on a dairy farm, and then her sister in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Her friend Clara Leiser also organized a party for her, and some of her friends from college came, and they they described a changed Mildred. Millie was not the Millie they remembered. There was something brittle about her. She seemed to not really want to talk to anybody. If somebody tried to ask her, "Oh, tell me about your life in Germany," she said, "Well, we don't talk about that." There was something very odd about her. Her brother actually thought that she was mad because she said to him, "I think I'm being watched." And he had no idea that she actually, that there was a legitimate reason for her to be concerned. She was deeply involved in the resistance at this point. And at least when she was in Berlin, she did have legitimate concern that she was under surveillance. And so in the United States, her family said, please stay, don't go back to Germany. And she refused. Ironically, some members of her family and her friends said that they thought that she had, quote, gone Nazi. This mm-hmm. was their way of sort of explaining to themselves why she seemed so changed.
Because of the cover that she needed to have to effectively live and survive and to gain intelligence in that environment, people actually thought she was sympathetic to the Nazis.
She did an extraordinary job of fooling people. Yep.
What lessons do you draw? Can we learn from Mildred's life?
Well, I think that Mildred can serve as an inspiration in these tremendously unsettling times. Her story really shows us that we must always take the risk of standing up to bullies and for fighting for what we believe in. This is a real story of courage and sacrifice. Mildred and her co-conspirators in the underground resistance took tremendous risks to thwart the Nazi regime. And I think that, her story also shows us that this is a very topical story, I think, for these times. And I've heard from a lot of readers who are drawing connections, and are saying between then and now, and who remark that our democracy is indeed fragile and that we cannot take democracy for granted. I think that, storming the Capitol in January 6th, this is one example of how fragile our democracy is. I mean, our democracy is still intact, but it's still under attack. And I think it's also important to remember that in Germany, there was a constitution. The Weimar Constitution guaranteed freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press. There were 90 daily newspapers in Berlin during the Weimar era. And all of these rights were taken away very swiftly, shortly after Hitler became chancellor. And in my book, I really put readers on the streets of Berlin and show them how. I write in the present tense. So this is unusual for a biography to write in the present tense. But I want readers to see, to experience this period of history as if it were happening right now, not as a distant sepia-toned, dust-caked story from the past, but something that is occurring right now so that they can make basically draw some inspiration and knowledge from the stories that these people's, from the lives of these people whose stories have not been told fully.
Rebecca Donner, such an impressive book. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Molly.
Rebecca Donner, author of All the Frequent Troubles of Our Days. I'm Molly Stentz. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.